Think we'll ever go home?
Dunno. I don't suppose I've got a home anyway. They probably couldn't have me back at Jordan College, and I can't live with the bears or the witches. Maybe I could live with Egyptians. I wouldn't mind that, if they'd have me.
What about Lord Asriel's world? Wouldn't you want to live there?
It's going to fail, remember?
Why?
Because of what your father's ghost said, just before we came out. About demons, and how they can only live for a long time if they stay in their own world. But probably Lord Asriel, I mean my father, couldn't have thought about that because no one knew enough about other worlds when he started. All that bravery and skill, all that, all wasted, all for nothing.
They climbed on, finding the going easy on the rock road, and when they reached the top of the ridge, they stopped and looked back.
Will, supposing we don't find them?
I'm sure we will. What I'm wondering is what my demon will be like.
You saw her. And I picked her up,
Lyra said, blushing, because of course it was a gross violation of manners to touch something so private as someone else's demon. It was forbidden not only by politeness, but by something deeper than that, something like shame. A quick glance at Will's warm cheeks showed that he knew that just as well as she did. They walked on side by side, suddenly shy with each other. But Will, not put off by being shy, said,
When does your demon stop changing shape?
I suppose about our age, or a bit older. Maybe more sometimes. We used to talk about Pan settling, him and me. We used to wonder what he'd be.
Don't people have any idea?
Not when they're young. As you grow up, you start thinking, well, they might be this, or they might be that. And usually they end up something that fits. I mean, something like your real nature. Like, if your demon's a dog, that means you like doing what you're told and knowing who's boss and following orders and pleasing people who are in charge. A lot of servants are people whose demons are dogs. So it helps to know what you're like and to find what you'd be good at. How do people in your world know what they're like?
I don't know. I don't know much about my world. All I know is keeping secret and quiet and hidden. So I don't know much about grown-ups and friends or lovers. I think it'd be difficult having a demon, because everybody would know so much about you just by looking. I like to keep secret and stay out of sight.
Then maybe your demon would be an animal that's good at hiding. Or one of those animals that looks like another. A butterfly that looks like a wasp for disguise. They must have creatures like that in your world, because we have. And we're so much alike.
They walked on together in a friendly silence. All around them the wide, clear morning lay limpid in the hollows and pearly blue in the warm air above. As far as the eye could see, the great savannah rolled, brown, gold, buff-green, shimmering towards the horizon, and empty. They might have been the only people in the world.
But it's not empty, really.
You mean that man?
No. You know what I mean.
Yes, I do. I can see shadows in the grass. Maybe birds,
Will said. He was following the little darting movements here and there. He found it easier to see the shadows if he didn't look at them. They were more willing to show themselves to the corners of his eye, and when he said so to Lyra, she said,
It's negative capability.
What's that?
The poet Keats said it first. Dr. Malone knows. It's how I read the alethiometer. It's how you use the knife, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is. But I was just thinking that they might be the demons.
So was I, but...
She put her finger to her lips. He nodded.
Look, there's one of those fallen trees.
It was Mary's climbing tree. They went up to it carefully, keeping an eye on the grove in case another one should fall. In the calm morning, with only a faint breeze stirring the leaves, it seemed impossible that a mighty thing like this should ever topple, but here it was. The vast trunk, supported in the grove by its torn-up roots and out on the grass by the mass of branches, was high above their heads. Some of those branches, crushed and broken, were themselves as big around as the biggest trees Will had ever seen. The crown of the tree, tight-packed with boughs that still looked sturdy, leaves that were still green, towered like a ruined palace into the mild air. Suddenly Lyra gripped Will's arm.
Shh! Don't look. I'm sure they're up there. I saw something move, and I swear it was Pan.
Her hand was warm. He was more aware of that than of the great mass of leaves and branches above them. Pretending to gaze vacantly at the horizon, he let his attention wander upwards into the confused mass of green, brown, and blue, and there, she was right. there was a something that was not the tree, and beside it, another.
Walk away. We'll go somewhere else and see if they follow us.
Suppose they don't. But yes, all right.
They pretended to look all around. They set their hands on one of the branches resting on the ground as if they were intending to climb. They pretended to change their minds by shaking their heads and walking away.
I wish we could look behind,
Lyra said when they were a few hundred yards away.
Just go on walking. They can see us and they won't get lost. They'll come to us when they want to.
They stepped off the black road and into the knee-high grass, swishing their legs through the stems, watching the insects hovering, darting, fluttering, skimming, hearing the million-voiced chorus chirrup and scrape.
What are you going to do, Will?
Lyra said after they'd walked some way in silence.
Well, I've got to go home.
She thought he sounded unsure, though. She hoped he sounded unsure.
But they might still be after you, those men.
We've seen worse than them after all.
Yes, I suppose. But I wanted to show you Jordan College and the fens. I wanted us to...
Yeah, and I wanted... It would be good to go to Chittagatse again, even. It was a beautiful place. And if the spectres are all gone... But there's my mother. I've got to go back and look after her. I just left her with Mrs. Cooper, and it's not fair on either of them.
But it's not fair on you to have to do that.
No, but that's a different sort of not fair. That's just like an earthquake or a rainstorm. It might not be fair, but no one's to blame. But if I just leave my mother with an old lady who isn't very well herself, then that's a different kind of not fair. That would be wrong. I've just got to go home. But probably it's going to be difficult to go back as we were. Probably the secret's out now. I don't suppose Mrs. Cooper will have been able to look after her. Not if my mother's in one of those times when she gets frightened of things. So she's probably had to get help, and when I go back, I'll be made to go into some kind of institution.
No! Like an orphanage!
I think that's what they do. I just don't know. I'll hate it.
You could escape with a knife, Will. You could come to my world.
I still belong there, where I can be with her. When I'm grown up, I'll be able to look after her properly, in my own house. No one can interfere then.
Do you think you'll get married?
He was quiet for a long time. She knew he was thinking, though.
I can't see that far ahead. It would have to be someone who understands about... I don't think there's anyone like that in my world. Would you get married?
Me too. Not to anyone in my world, I shouldn't think.
They walked on steadily, wandering towards the horizon. They had all the time in the world, all the time the world had. After a while, Lyra said,
You will keep the knife, won't you? So you could visit my world?
Of course. I certainly wouldn't give it to anyone else, ever.
Don't look,
she said, not altering her pace.
There they are again, on the left.
They are following us.
Shh.
I thought they would. Okay, we'll just pretend now. We'll just wander along as if we're looking for them, and we'll look in all sorts of stupid places.
It became a game. They found a pond and searched among the reeds and in the mud, saying loudly that the demons were bound to be shaped like frogs or water beetles or slugs. They peeled off the bark of a long fallen tree at the edge of a stringwood grove, pretending to have seen the two demons creeping underneath it in the form of earwigs. Lyra made a great fuss of an ant she claimed to have trodden on, sympathizing with its bruises, saying its face was just like Pan's, asking in mock sorrow why it was refusing to speak to her. But when she thought they were genuinely out of earshot, she said earnestly to Will, leaning close to speak quietly,
We had to leave them, didn't we? We didn't have a choice, really.
Yes, we had to. It was worse for you than for me, but we didn't have any choice at all, because you made a promise to Roger and you had to keep it.
And you had to speak to your father again.
And we had to let them all out.
Yes, we did. I'm so glad we did. Pan will be glad one day too, when I die. We won't be split up. It was a good thing we did.
As the sun rose higher in the sky and the air became warmer, they began to look for shade. Towards noon they found themselves on the slope rising towards the summit of a ridge, and when they'd reached it, Lyra flopped down on the grass.
Well, if we don't find somewhere shady soon...
There was a valley leading down on the other side, and it was thick with bushes, so they guessed there might be a stream as well. They traversed the slope of the ridge till it dipped into the head of the valley, and there, sure enough, among ferns and reeds, a spring bubbled out of the rock. They dipped their hot faces in the water and swallowed gratefully, and then they followed the stream downwards, seeing it gather in miniature whirlpools and pour over tiny ledges of stone, and all the time get fuller and wider.
How does it do that? There's no more water coming into it from anywhere else, but there's so much more of it here than up there.
Will, watching the shadows out of the corner of his eye, saw them slip ahead, leaping over the ferns to disappear into the bushes further down. He pointed silently.
It just goes slower. It doesn't flow as fast as the spring comes out, so it gathers in these pools. They've gone in there,
he whispered, indicating a little group of trees at the foot of the slope. They looked at each other, a curiously formal and serious look, before setting off to follow the stream. The undergrowth got thicker as they went down the valley. The stream went into tunnels of green and emerged in dappled clearings, only to tumble over a lip of stone and bury itself in the green again, and they had to follow it as much by hearing as by sight. At the foot of the hill, it ran into the little wood of silver-barked trees. Father Gomez watched from the top of the ridge. It hadn't been hard to follow them. Despite Mary's confidence in the open savannah, there was plenty of concealment in the grass and the occasional thickets of stringwood and saplacker bushes. The two young people had spent a lot of time earlier looking all around as if they thought they were being followed. He had had to keep some distance away, but as the morning passed, they became more and more absorbed in each other and paid less attention to the landscape. The one thing he didn't want to do was hurt the boy. He had a horror of harming an innocent person. The only way to make sure of his target was to get close enough to see her clearly, which meant following them into the wood. Quietly and cautiously he moved down the course of the stream. His demon, the green-backed beetle, flew overhead, tasting the air. Her eyesight was less good than his, but her sense of smell was acute, and she caught the scent of the young people's flesh very clearly. She would go a little ahead, perch on a stem of grass, and wait for him, then move on again. And as she caught the trail in the air that their bodies left behind, Father Gomez found himself praising God for his mission, because it was clearer than ever that the boy and the girl were walking into mortal sin. He watched them go in among the trees. They hadn't looked back once since coming over the top of the ridge, but he still kept low, moving down the stream at a crouch, holding the rifle in one hand, balancing with the other. He was so close to success now that for the first time he found himself speculating on what he would do afterwards, and whether he would please the kingdom of heaven more by going back to Geneva or staying to evangelize this world. The first thing to do here would be to convince the four-legged creatures, who seemed to have the rudiments of reason, that their habit of riding on wheels was abominable and satanic and contrary to the will of God. Break them of that, and salvation would follow. He reached the foot of the slope, where the trees began, and laid the rifle down silently. He gazed into the silver, green, gold shadows and listened, with both hands behind his ears to catch and focus any quiet voices through the insect chirping and the trickle of the stream. Yes, there they were. They'd stopped. He bent to pick up the rifle, and found himself uttering a hoarse and breathless gasp as something clutched his demon and pulled her away from him. But there was nothing there. Where was she? The pain was atrocious. He heard her crying and cast about wildly to left and right, looking for her.
Keep still,
said a voice from the air.
And be quiet. I have your demon in my hand.
But where are you? Who are you?
My name is Balthamos.
Will and Lyra followed the stream into the wood, walking carefully, saying little, until they were in the very center. There was a little clearing in the middle of the grove, which was floored with soft grass and moss-covered rocks. The branches laced across overhead, almost shutting out the sky and letting through little moving spangles and sequins of sunlight, so that everything was dappled with gold and silver. And it was quiet. Only the trickle of the stream and the occasional rustle of leaves high up in a little curl of breeze broke the silence. Will put down the package of food. Lyra put down her little rucksack. There was no sign of the demon shadows anywhere. They were completely alone. They took off their shoes and socks and sat down on the mossy rocks at the edge of the stream, dipping their feet in the cold water and feeling the shock of it invigorate their blood.
I'm hungry.
Me too,
said Lyra, though she was also feeling more than that, something subdued and pressing and half happy and half painful, so that she wasn't quite sure what it was. They unfolded the cloth and ate some bread and cheese. For some reason their hands were slow and clumsy, and they hardly tasted the food, although the bread was floury and crisp from the hot baking stones, and the cheese was flaky and salty and very fresh. Then Lyra took one of those little red fruits. With a fast-beating heart, she turned to him and said,
"Will."
And she lifted the fruit gently to his mouth. She could see from his eyes that he knew at once what she meant, and that he was too joyful to speak. Her fingers were still at his lips, and he felt them tremble, and he put his own hand up to hold hers there, and then neither of them could look. They were confused. They were brimming with happiness. Like two moths clumsily bumping together, with no more weight than that, their lips touched. Then, before they knew how it happened, they were clinging together, blindly pressing their faces towards each other.
Like Mary said, you know straight away when you like someone. When you were asleep, on the mountain before she took you away, I told Pan...
I heard. I was awake, and I wanted to tell you the same. And now I know what I must have felt all the time. I love you, Will. I love you.
The word love set his nerves ablaze. All his body thrilled with it, and he answered her in the same words, kissing her hot face over and over again, drinking in with adoration the scent of her body and her warm, honey-fragrant hair, and her sweet, moist mouth that tasted of the little red fruit. Around them there was nothing but silence, as if all the world were holding its breath. Balthamos was terrified. He moved up the stream and away from the wood, holding the scratching, stinging, biting insect demon, and trying to conceal himself as much as he could from the man who was stumbling after them. He mustn't let him catch up. He knew that Father Gomez would kill him in a moment. An angel of his rank was no match for a man, even if that angel was strong and healthy, and Balthamos was neither of those. Besides which, he was crippled by grief over Baruch and shame at having deserted Will before. He no longer even had the strength to fly.
"Stop! Stop!"
said Father Gomez.
"Please keep still. I can't see you. Let's talk, please. Don't hurt my demon, I beg you!"
In fact, the demon was hurting Balthamos. The angel could see the little green thing dimly through the backs of his clasped hands, and she was sinking her powerful jaws again and again into his palms. If he opened his hands just for a moment, she would be gone. Balthamos kept them closed.
"This way. Follow me. Come away from the wood. I want to talk to you, and this is the wrong place."
"But who are you? I can't see you. Come closer. How can I tell what you are till I see you? Keep still, don't move so quickly."
But moving quickly was the only defense Balthamos had. Trying to ignore the stinging demon, he picked his way up the little gully where the stream ran, stepping from rock to rock. Then he made a mistake. Trying to look behind him, he slipped and put a foot into the water.
"Ah,"
came a whisper of satisfaction as Father Gomez saw the splash. Balthamos withdrew his foot at once and hurried on, but now a wet print appeared on the dry rocks each time he put his foot down. The priest saw it and leapt forward and felt the brush of feathers on his hand. He stopped in astonishment. The word angel reverberated in his mind. Balthamos seized the moment to stumble forward again, and the priest felt himself dragged after him as another brutal pang wrenched his heart. Balthamos said over his shoulder,
"A little further, just to the top of the ridge, and we shall talk, I promise."
"Talk here. Stop where you are, and I swear I shan't touch you."
The angel didn't reply. It was too hard to concentrate. He had to split his attention three ways, behind him to avoid the man, ahead to see where he was going, and on the furious demon tormenting his hands. As for the priest, his mind was working quickly. A truly dangerous opponent would have killed his demon at once and ended the matter there and then. This antagonist was afraid to strike. With that in mind, he let himself stumble and uttered little moans of pain and pleaded once or twice for the other to stop, all the time watching closely, moving nearer, estimating how big the other was, how quickly he could move, which way he was looking.
"Please, you don't know how much this hurts. I can't do you any harm. Please, can we stop and talk?"
He didn't want to move out of sight of the wood. They were now at the point where the stream began, and he could see the shape of Balthamos's feet very lightly pressing the grass. The priest had watched every inch of the way, and he was sure now where the angel was standing. Balthamos turned around. The priest raised his eyes to the place where he thought the angel's face would be, and saw him for the first time, just a shimmer in the air, but there was no mistaking it. The angel wasn't quite close enough to reach in one movement, though, and in truth the pull on his demon had been painful and weakening. Maybe he should take another step or two.
"Sit down,"
said Balthamos.
"Sit down where you are, not a step closer."
"What do you want?"
said Father Gomez, not moving.
What do I want? I want to kill you, but I haven't got the strength.
But are you an angel?
What does it matter?
You might have made a mistake. We might be on the same side.
No, we're not. I've been following you. I know whose side you're on. No, no, don't move. Stay there.
It's not too late to repent. Even angels are allowed to do that. Let me hear your confession.
Oh, Baruch, help me,
cried Balthamos in despair, turning away. And as he cried out, Father Gomez leapt for him. His shoulder hit the angel's and knocked Balthamos off balance. And in throwing out a hand to save himself, the angel let go of the insect demon. The beetle flew free at once, and Father Gomez felt a surge of relief and strength. In fact, it was that which killed him, to his great surprise. He hurled himself so hard at the faint form of the angel, and he expected so much more resistance than he met, that he couldn't keep his balance. His foot slipped, his momentum carried him down towards the stream, and Balthamos, thinking of what Baruch would have done, kicked aside the priest's hand as he flung it out for support. Father Gomez fell hard, his head cracked against a stone, and he fell stunned with his face in the water. The cold shock woke him at once, but as he choked and feebly tried to rise, Balthamos, desperate, ignored the demon stinging his face and his eyes and his mouth, and used all the little weight he had to hold the man's head down in the water, and he kept it there, and kept it there, and kept it there. When the demon suddenly vanished, Balthamos let go. The man was dead. As soon as he was sure, Balthamos hauled the body out of the stream and laid it carefully on the grass, folding the priest's hands over his breast and closing his eyes. Then Balthamos stood up, sick and weary and full of pain.
Baruch, oh Baruch, my dear, I can do no more. Will and the girl are safe, and everything will be well. But this is the end for me. Though truly I died when you did, Baruch, my beloved.
A moment later, he was gone. In the bean field, drowsy in the late afternoon heat, Mary heard Atal's voice, and she couldn't tell excitement from alarm. Had another tree fallen? Had the man with the rifle appeared?
Look! Look!
Atal was saying, nudging Mary's pocket with her trunk. So Mary took the spyglass and did as her friend said, pointing it up to the sky.
Tell me what it's doing,
said Atal.
I can feel it is different, but I can't see.
The terrible flood of dust in the sky had stopped flowing. It wasn't still by any means. Mary scanned the whole sky with the amber lens, seeing a current here, an eddy there, a vortex further off. It was in perpetual movement, but it wasn't flowing away anymore. In fact, if anything, it was falling like snowflakes. She thought of the wheel trees, the flowers that opened upwards would be drinking in this golden rain. Mary could almost feel them welcoming it in their poor, parched throats, which were so perfectly shaped for it, and which had been starved for so long.
The young ones,
said Atal. Mary turned, spyglass in hand, to see Will and Lyra returning. They were some way off. They weren't hurrying. They were holding hands, talking together, heads close, oblivious to everything else. She could see that even from a distance. She nearly put the spyglass to her eye, but held back and returned it to her pocket. There was no need for the glass. She knew what she would see. They would seem to be made of living gold. They would seem the true image of what human beings always could be, once they had come into their inheritance. The dust pouring down from the stars had found a living home again, and these children no longer children, saturated with love, were the cause of it all. Chapter 36 The Broken Arrow.
But fate does iron wedges drive, and always crowds itself betwixt. Andrew Marvel.
The two demons moved through the silent village, in and out of the shadows, padding cat-formed across the moonlit gathering floor, pausing outside the open door of Mary's house. Cautiously they looked inside and saw only the sleeping woman, so they withdrew and moved through the moonlight again, towards the shelter tree. Its long branches trailed their fragrant corkscrew leaves almost down to the ground. Very slowly, very careful not to rustle a leaf or snap a fallen twig, the two shapes slipped in through the leaf curtain and saw what they were seeking. The boy and the girl, fast asleep in each other's arms. They moved closer over the grass and touched the sleepers softly with nose, paw, whiskers, bathing in the life-giving warmth they gave off, but being infinitely careful not to wake them. As they checked their people, gently cleaning Will's fast-healing wound, lifting the lock of hair off Lyra's face, there was a soft sound behind them. Instantly, in total silence, both demons sprang around, becoming wolves, mad light eyes, bare white teeth, menace in every line. A woman stood there, outlined by the moon. It was not Mary, and when she spoke, they heard her clearly, though her voice made no sound.
"Come with me,"
she said. Pantalaimon's demon heart leapt within him, but he said nothing until he could greet her away from the sleepers under the tree.
"Seraphina Pekala, where have you been? Do you know what's happened?"
"Hush. Let's fly to a place where we can talk,"
she said, mindful of the sleeping villagers. Her branch of cloud pine lay by the door of Mary's house, and as she took it up, the two demons changed into birds, a nightingale, an owl, and flew with her over the thatched roofs, over the grasslands, over the ridge, and towards the nearest wheel tree grove, as huge as a castle, its crown looking like curds of silver in the moonlight. There Seraphina Pekala settled on the highest comfortable branch, among the open flowers drinking in the dust, and the two birds perched nearby.
"You won't be birds for long. Very soon now, your shapes will settle. Look around and take this sight into your memory."
"What will we be?"
said Pantalaimon.
"You'll find out sooner than you think. Listen, and I'll tell you some witch lore that none but witches know. The reason I can do that is that you are here with me, and your humans are down there, sleeping. Who are the only people for whom that is possible?"
"Witches. And shamans. So..."
"In leaving you both on the shores of the world of the dead, Lyra and Will did something, without knowing it, that witches have done since the first time there were witches. There's a region of our Northland, a desolate, abominable place, where a great catastrophe happened in the childhood of the world, and where nothing has lived since. No demons can enter it. To become a witch, a girl must cross it alone and leave her demon behind. You know the suffering they must undergo. But having done it, they find that their demons were not severed, as in Volvanga. They are still one whole being. But now they can roam free and go to far places and see strange things and bring back knowledge. And you are not severed, are you?"
"No, we are still one. But it was so painful, and we were so frightened."
"Well, the two of them will not fly like witches, and they will not live as long as we do. But thanks to what they did, you and they are witch in all but that."
The two demons considered the strangeness of this knowledge.
"Does that mean we shall be birds? Like witches' demons?"
"Be patient."
"And how can Will be a witch? I thought all witches were female."
"Those two have changed many things. We are all learning new ways, even witches. But one thing hasn't changed. You must help your humans, not hinder them. You must help them and guide them and encourage them towards wisdom. That's what demons are for."
They were silent. Seraphina turned to the nightingale.
"What is your name?"
"I have no name. I didn't know I was born until I was torn away from his heart."
"Then I shall name you Kiryava."
"Kiryava,"
said Pantalaimon, trying the sound.
"What does it mean?"
"Soon you will see what it means. But now you must listen carefully, because I'm going to tell you what you should do."
"No,"
said Kiryava.
"I can hear from your tone that you know what I'm going to say."
"We don't want to hear it."
"It's too soon. It's much too soon."
Seraphina was silent because she agreed with them, and she felt sorrowful. She was the wisest one there, and she had to guide them to what was right. But she let their agitation subside before she went on.
"Where did you go in your wanderings?"
"Through many worlds. Everywhere we found a window, we went through. There are more windows than we thought."
"And you saw?"
"Yes. We looked closely, and we saw what was happening."
"We saw many other things. We met an angel, and we saw the world where the little people come from, the Galavespians. There are big people there, too, who try and kill them.
They told the witch more of what they'd seen, and they were trying to distract her, and she knew it. But she let them talk because of the love each one had for the other's voice. But eventually they ran out of things to tell her, and they fell silent. The only sound was the gentle, endless whisper of the leaves.
You have been keeping away from Will and Lyra to punish them. I know why you're doing that. My Kaiser did just the same after I came through the desolate barrens. But he came to me eventually because we loved each other still. And they will need you soon to help them do what has to be done next. Because you have to tell them what you know.
Pantalaimon cried aloud, a pure cold owl cry, a sound never heard in that world before. In nests and burrows for a long way around, and wherever any small night creature was hunting or grazing or scavenging, a new and unforgettable fear came into being. Serafina watched from close by, and felt nothing but compassion until she looked at Will's demon, Kiriava the Nightingale. She remembered talking to the witch Rutaskadi, who had asked, after seeing Will only once, if Serafina had looked into his eyes, and Serafina had replied that she had not dared to. This little brown bird was radiating an implacable ferocity as palpable as heat, and Serafina was afraid of it. Finally, Pantalaimon's wild screaming died away, and Kiriava said,
"And we have to tell them."
"Yes, you do."
Gradually, the ferocity left the gaze of the little brown bird, and Serafina could look at her again. She saw a desolate sadness in its place.
"There is a ship coming. I left it to fly here and find you. I came with the Egyptians, all the way from our world. They will be here in another day or so."
The two birds sat close, and in a moment they had changed their forms, becoming two doves.
"This may be the last time you fly. I can see a little ahead. I can see that you will both be able to climb this high as long as there are trees this size. But I think you will not be birds when your forms settle. Take in all that you can, and remember it well. I know that you and Lyra and Will are going to think hard and painfully, and I know you will make the best choice. But it is yours to make, and no one else's."
They didn't speak. She took her branch of cloud pine and lifted away from the towering treetops, circling high above, feeling on her skin the coolness of the breeze and the tingle of the starlight, and the benevolent sifting of that dust she had never seen. She flew down to the village once more and went silently into the woman's house. She knew nothing about Mary except that she came from the same world as Will, and that her part in the events was crucial. Whether she was fierce or friendly, Serafina had no way of telling, but she had to wake Mary up without startling her, and there was a spell for that. She sat on the floor at the woman's head and watched through half-closed eyes, breathing in and out in time with her. Presently her half-vision began to show her the pale forms that Mary was seeing in her dreams, and she adjusted her mind to resonate with them, as if she were tuning a string. Then, with a further effort, Serafina herself stepped in among them. Once she was there, she could speak to Mary, and she did so with the instant, easy affection that we sometimes feel for people we meet in dreams. A moment later they were talking together in a murmured rush of which Mary later remembered nothing, and walking through a silly landscape of reed beds and electrical transformers. It was time for Serafina to take charge.
"In a few moments, you'll wake up. Don't be alarmed. You'll find me beside you. I'm waking you like this, so you'll know it's quite safe, and there's nothing to hurt you. And then we can talk properly."
She withdrew, taking the dream Mary with her, until she found herself in the house again, cross-legged on the earthen floor, with Mary's eyes glittering as they looked at her.
"You must be the witch."
"I am. My name is Serafina Pekala. What are you called?"
"Mary Malone. I've never been woken so quietly. Am I awake?"
"Yes. We must talk together. And dream talk is hard to control and harder to remember. It's better to talk awake. Do you prefer to stay inside, or will you walk with me in the moonlight?"
"I'll come,"
said Mary, sitting up and stretching.
"Where are the others?"
"Asleep under the tree."
They moved out of the house and past the tree with its curtain of all-concealing leaves, and walked down to the river. Mary watched Serafina Pekela with a mixture of wariness and admiration. She had never seen a human form so slender and graceful. She seemed younger than Mary herself, though Lyra had said she was hundreds of years old. The only hint of age came in her expression, which was full of a complicated sadness. They sat on the bank over the silver-black water, and Serafina told her that she had spoken to the children's demons.
They went looking for them today. But something else happened. Will's never seen his demon. He didn't know for certain that he had one.
Well, he has. And so have you.
Mary stared at her.
If you could see him, you would see a black bird with red legs and a bright yellow beak, slightly curved. A bird of the mountains.
An alpine chough. How can you see him?
With my eyes half closed, I can see him. If we had time, I could teach you to see him too, and to see the demons of others in your world. It's strange for us to think you can't see them.
Then she told Mary what she had said to the demons, and what it meant.
And the demons will have to tell them.
I thought of waking them to tell them myself. I thought of telling you and letting you have the responsibility. But I saw their demons, and I knew that would be best.
They're in love.
I know.
They've only just discovered it.
Mary tried to take in all the implications of what Serafina had told her, but it was too hard.
Can you see dust?
No, I've never seen it. And until the wars began, we had never heard of it.
Mary took the spyglass from her pocket and handed it to the witch. Serafina put it to her eye and gasped.
That is dust. It's beautiful.
Turn to look back at the shelter tree.
Serafina did.
They did this.
Something happened today, or yesterday if it's after midnight,
Mary said, trying to find the words to explain, and remembering her vision of the dust flow as a great river like the Mississippi.
Something tiny but crucial. If you wanted to divert a mighty river into a different course, and all you had was a single pebble, you could do it as long as you put the pebble in the right place to send the first trickle of water that way instead of this. Something like that happened yesterday. I don't know what it was. They saw each other differently or something. Until then, they hadn't felt like that, but suddenly they did, and then the dust was attracted to them very powerfully, and it stopped flowing the other way.
So that was how it was to happen. And now it's safe. Or it will be when the angels fill the great chasm in the underworld.
She told Mary about the abyss, and about how she herself had found out.
I was flying high, looking for a landfall, and I met an angel. A female angel. She was very strange. She was old and young together,
she went on, forgetting that that was how she herself appeared to Mary.
Her name was Zaphania. She told me many things. She said that all the history of human life has been a struggle between wisdom and stupidity. She and the rebel angels, the followers of wisdom, have always tried to open minds. The authority and his churches have always tried to keep them closed. She gave me many examples from my world.
I can think of many from mine.
And for most of that time, wisdom has had to work in secret, whispering her words, moving like a spy through the humble places of the world, while the courts and palaces are occupied by her enemies.
Yes, I recognize that too.
And the struggle isn't over now, though the forces of the kingdom have met a setback. They'll regroup under a new commander and come back strongly, and we must be ready to resist.
But what happened to Lord Azrael?
He fought the Regent of Heaven, the angel Metatron, and he wrestled him down into the abyss. Metatron is gone forever. So is Lord Azrael.
And Mrs. Coulter?
As an answer, the witch took an arrow from her quiver. She took her time selecting it, the best, the straightest, the most perfectly balanced, and she broke it in two.
Once, in my world, I saw that woman torturing a witch, and I swore to myself that I would send that arrow into her throat. Now I shall never do that. She sacrificed herself with Lord Asriel to fight the angel and make the world safe for Lyra. They could not have done it alone, but together they did it.
How can we tell Lyra?
Wait until she asks. And she might not. In any case, she has her symbol reader. That will tell her anything she wants to know.
They sat in silence for a while, companionably, as the stars slowly wheeled in the sky.
Can you see ahead and guess what they'll choose to do?
No. But if Lyra returns to her own world, then I will be her sister as long as she lives. What will you do?
Mary began, and found she hadn't considered that for a moment.
I suppose I belong in my own world, though I'll be sorry to leave this one. I've been very happy here. The happiest I've ever been in my life, I think.
Well, if you do return home, you shall have a sister in another world, and so shall I. We shall see each other again in a day or so when the ship arrives, and we'll talk more on the voyage home, and then we'll part forever. Embrace me now, sister.
Mary did so, and Serafina Pekela flew away on her cloud pine branch over the reeds, over the marshes, over the mud flats and the beach, and over the sea, until Mary could see her no more. At about the same time, one of the large blue lizards came across the body of Father Gomez. Will and Lyra had returned to the village that afternoon by a different route, and hadn't seen it. The priest lay undisturbed where Balthamos had laid him. The lizards were scavengers, but they were mild and harmless creatures, and by an ancient understanding with the Mulefa, they were entitled to take any creature left dead after dark. The lizard dragged the priest's body back to her nest, and her children feasted very well. As for the rifle, it lay in the grass where Father Gomez had laid it down, quietly turning to rust. Chapter 37 The Dunes.
My soul, do not seek eternal life, but exhaust the realm of the possible. Pindar.
Next day Will and Lyra went out by themselves again, speaking little, eager to be alone with each other. They looked dazed, as if some happy accident had robbed them of their wits. They moved slowly. Their eyes were not focused on what they looked at. They spent all day on the wide hills, and in the heat of the afternoon they visited their gold and silver grove. They talked, they bathed, they ate, they kissed. They lay in a trance of happiness, murmuring words whose sound was as confused as their sense, and they felt they were melting with love. In the evening they shared the meal with Mary and Atal, saying little, and because the air was hot, they thought they'd walk down to the sea, where there might be a cool breeze. They wandered along the river until they came to the wide beach, bright under the moon, where the low tide was turning. They lay down in the soft sand at the foot of the dunes, and then they heard the first bird calling. They both turned their heads at once, because it was a bird that sounded like no creature that belonged to the world they were in. From somewhere above in the dark came a delicate trilling song, and then another answered it from a different direction. Delighted, Will and Lyra jumped up and tried to see the singers, but all they could make out was a pair of dark, skimming shapes that flew low and then darted up again, all the time singing and singing in rich, liquid bell tones, an endlessly varied song. And then, with a flutter of wings that threw up a little fountain of sand in front of him, the first bird landed a few yards away. Lyra said,
"Pan?"
He was formed like a dove, but his colour was dark and hard to tell in the moonlight. At any rate, he showed up clearly on the white sand. The other bird still circled overhead, still singing, and then she flew down to join him, another dove, but pearl-white and with a crest of dark red feathers. And Will knew what it was to see his demon. As she flew down to the sand, he felt his heart tighten and release in a way he never forgot. 60 years and more would go by, and as an old man he would still feel some sensations as bright and fresh as ever. Lyra's fingers putting the fruit between his lips under the gold and silver trees, her warm mouth pressing against his demon being torn from his unsuspecting breast as they entered the world of the dead, and the sweet rightfulness of her coming back to him at the edge of the moonlit dunes. Lyra made to move towards them, but Pantalaimon spoke.
"Lyra, Serafina Pekela came to us last night. She told us all kinds of things. She's gone back to guide the Egyptians here. Father Coram's coming, and Lord Far, and they'll be here...
Pan! Oh, Pan, you're not happy. What is it? What is it?
Then he changed, and flowed over the sand to her as a snow-white ermine. The other demon changed too. Will felt it happen like a little grip at his heart, and became a cat. Before she moved to him, she spoke.
The witch gave me a name. I had no need of one before. She called me Kiryava. But listen, listen to us now.
Yes, you must listen,
said Pantalaimon.
This is hard to explain.
Between them, the demons managed to tell them everything Seraphina had told them, beginning with the revelation about the children's own natures, about how, without intending it, they had become like witches in their power to separate and yet still be one being.
But that's not all.
Oh, Lyra, forgive us, but we have to tell you what we found out.
Lyra was bewildered. When had Pan ever needed forgiving? She looked at Will and saw his puzzlement as clear as her own.
Tell us. Don't be afraid.
It's about dust,
said the cat demon, and Will marveled to hear part of his own nature telling him something he didn't know.
It was all flowing away, all the dust there was, down into the abyss that you saw. Something stopped it flowing down there, but...
Will! It was that golden light! The light that all flowed into the abyss and vanished! And that was dust? Was it really?
Yes, but there's more leaking out all the time. And it mustn't. It mustn't all leak away. It's got to stay in the world and not vanish, because otherwise everything good will fade away and die.
But where's the rest leaving from?
Both demons looked at Will and at the knife.
Every time we made an opening,
said Kiryava, and again Will felt that little thrill. She's me and I'm her.
Every time anyone made an opening between the worlds, us or the old guild men, anyone, the knife cut into the emptiness outside. The same emptiness there is down in the abyss. We never knew. No one knew, because the edge was too fine to see, but it was quite big enough for dust to leak out of. If they closed it up again at once, there wasn't time for much to leak out, but there were thousands that they never closed up. So all this time, dust has been leaking out of the worlds and into nothingness.
The understanding was beginning to dawn on Will and Lyra. They fought it, they pushed it away, but it was just like the grey light that seeps into the sky and extinguishes the stars. It crept past every barrier they could put up and under every blind and around the edges of every curtain they could draw against it.
Every opening.
Every single one. They must all be closed.
Every single one,
said Pantalaimon.
Oh, no. No. It can't be true. And so we must leave our world to stay in Lyra's. Or Pan and Lyra must leave theirs and come to stay in ours. There's no other choice.
Then the full bleak daylight struck in. And Lyra cried aloud. Pantalaimon's owl cry the night before had frightened every small creature that heard it, but it was nothing to the passionate wail that Lyra uttered now. The demons were shocked, and Will, seeing their reaction, understood why. They didn't know the rest of the truth. They didn't know what Will and Lyra themselves had learned. Lyra was shaking with anger and grief, striding up and down with clenched fists, and turning her tear-streaming face this way and that as if looking for an answer. Will jumped up and seized her shoulders, and felt her tense and trembling.
Listen! Lyra, listen! What did my father say?
Oh!
She cried, tossing her head this way and that.
He said... You know what he said! You were there, Will! You listened too!
He thought she would die of her grief there and then. She flung herself into his arms and sobbed, clinging passionately to his shoulders, pressing her nails into his back and her face into his neck, and all he could hear was...
No! No! No!
Listen... Lyra, let's try and remember it exactly. There might be a way through. There might be a loophole.
He disengaged her arms gently and made her sit down. At once Pantalaimon, frightened, flowed up onto her lap, and the cat demon tentatively came close to Will. They hadn't touched yet, but now he put out a hand to her and she moved her cat face against his fingers and then stepped delicately onto his lap.
He said that people could spend a little time in other worlds without being affected. They could. And we have, haven't we? Apart from what we had to do to go into the world of the dead, we're still healthy, aren't we?
They can spend a little time, but not a long time. My father had been away from his world, my world, for 10 years. And he was nearly dying when I found him. 10 years, that's all.
But what about Lord Boreal? Sir Charles? He was healthy enough, wasn't he?
Yes, but remember, he could go back to his own world whenever he liked and get healthy again. That's where you saw him first, after all, in your world. He must have found some secret window that no one else knew about.
Well, we could do that.
We could, except that...
All the windows must be closed,
said Pantalaimon.
All of them.
But how do you know? An angel told us,
said Kiriava.
We met an angel. She told us all about that and other things as well. It's true, Lyra. She? It was a female angel. I've never heard of one of them. Maybe she was lying.
Will was thinking through another possibility.
Suppose they closed all the other windows, and we just made one when we needed to, and went through as quickly as we could and closed it up immediately. That would be safe, surely. If we didn't leave much time for dust to go out?
Yes!
We'd make it where no one could ever find it, and only us two would know.
Oh, it would work. I'm sure it would.
And we could go from one to the other, and stay healthy.
But the demons were distressed, and Kiriava was murmuring,
No, no.
And Pantalaimon said,
The spectres. She told us about the spectres, too.
The spectres? We saw them during the battle for the first time. What about them?
Well... We found out where they come from,
said Kiriava.
And this is the worst thing. They're like the children of the abyss. Every time we open a window with the knife, it makes a spectre. It's like a little bit of the abyss that floats out and enters the world. That's why the Chittagatse world was so full of them, because of all the windows they left open there.
And they grow by feeding on dust,
said Pantalaimon.
And on demons. Because dust and demons are sort of similar. Grown-up demons, anyway. And the spectres get bigger and stronger as they do.
Will felt a dull horror at his heart, and Kiriava pressed herself against his breast, feeling it too, and trying to comfort him.
So every time I've used the knife, every single time I've made another spectre come to life.
He remembered Yorick Birnison, in the cave where he'd forged the knife again, saying, What you don't know is what the knife does on its own. Your intentions may be good. The knife has intentions, too. Lyra's eyes were watching him, wide with anguish.
Oh, we can't, Will. We can't do that to people. Not let other spectres out. Not now we've seen what they do.
All right,
he said, getting to his feet, holding his demon close to his breast.
Then we'll have to... One of us will have to... I'll come to your world, and...
She knew what he was going to say, and she saw him holding the beautiful, healthy demon he hadn't even begun to know. And she thought of his mother, and she knew that he was thinking of her, too. To abandon her and live with Lyra, even for the few years they'd have together. Could he do that? He might be living with Lyra, but she knew he wouldn't be able to live with himself.
No!
She cried, jumping up beside him, and Kiriava joined Pantalaimon on the sand as boy and girl clung together desperately.
I'll do it, Will! We'll come to your world and live there. It doesn't matter if we get ill, me and Pan. We're strong. I bet we last a good long time. And there are probably good doctors in your world. Dr. Malone would know. Oh, let's do that.
He was shaking his head, and she saw the brilliance of tears on his cheeks.
Do you think I could bear that, Lyra? Do you think I could live happily watching you get sick and ill and fade away and then die? While I was getting stronger and more grown up day by day. 10 years. That's nothing. It'd pass in a flash. We'd be in our 20s. It's not that far ahead. Think of that, Lyra. You and me grown up, just preparing to do all the things we want to do. And then... It all comes to an end. Do you think I could bear to live on after you died? Oh, Lyra, I'd follow you down to the world of the dead without thinking twice about it, just like you followed Roger. And that would be two lives gone for nothing. My life wasted like yours. No, we should spend our whole lifetimes together, good, long, busy lives. And if we can't spend them together, we... will have to spend them apart.
Biting her lip, she watched him as he walked up and down in his distracted anguish. He stopped and turned.
Do you remember another thing he said? My father. He said we have to build the Republic of Heaven where we are. He said that for us there isn't any elsewhere.
That's what he meant. I can see now. Oh, it's too bitter. I thought he just meant Lord Asriel and his new world, but he meant us. He meant you and me. We have to live in our own worlds.
I'm going to ask the alethiometer. That'll know. I don't know why I didn't think of it before.
She sat down, wiping her cheeks with the palm of one hand and reaching for the rucksack with the other. She carried it everywhere. When Will thought of her in later years, it was often with that little bag over her shoulder. She tucked the hair behind her ears in the swift movement he loved, and took out the black velvet bundle.
"Can you see?"
he said, for although the moon was bright, the symbols around the face were very small.
"I know where they all are. I got it off by heart. Hush now."
She crossed her legs, pulling the skirt over them to make a lap. Will lay on one elbow and watched. The bright moonlight, reflected off the white sand, lit up her face with a radiance that seemed to draw out some other radiance from inside her. Her eyes glittered, and her expression was so serious and absorbed that Will could have fallen in love with her again if love didn't already possess every fibre of his being. Lyra took a deep breath and began to turn the wheels. But after only a few moments, she stopped and turned the instrument around.
"Wrong place,"
she said briefly, and tried again. Will, watching, saw her beloved face clearly. And because he knew it so well, and he'd studied her expression in happiness and despair and hope and sorrow, he could tell that something was wrong. For there was no sign of the clear concentration she used to sink into so quickly. Instead, an unhappy bewilderment spread gradually over her. She bit her lower lip, she blinked more and more, and her eyes moved slowly from symbol to symbol, almost at random, instead of darting swiftly and certainly.
"I don't know. I don't know what's happening. I know it so well, but I can't seem to see what it means."
She took a deep, shuddering breath and turned the instrument around. It looked strange and awkward in her hands. Pantalaimon, mouse-formed, crept into her lap and rested his black paws on the crystal, peering at one symbol after another. Lyra turned one wheel, turned another, turned the whole thing around, and then looked up at Will, stricken.
"Oh, Will, I can't do it. It's left me."
"Hush. Don't fret. It's still there inside you, all that knowledge. Just be calm and let yourself find it. Don't force it. Just sort of float down to touch it."
She gulped and nodded and angrily brushed her wrist across her eyes and took several deep breaths, but he could see she was too tense, and he put his hands on her shoulders and then felt her trembling and hugged her tight. She pulled back and tried again. Once more she gazed at the symbols, once more she turned the wheels, but those invisible ladders of meaning down which she'd stepped with such ease and confidence weren't there. She just didn't know what any of the symbols meant. She turned away and clung to Will and said desperately,
"It's no good. I can tell. It's gone forever. It just came when I needed it, for all the things I had to do, for rescuing Roger, and then for us two. And now that it's over, now that everything's finished, it's just left me. It's gone, Will. I've lost it. It'll never come back."
She sobbed with desperate abandon. All he could do was hold her. He didn't know how to comfort her, because it was plain that she was right. Then both the demons bristled and looked up. Will and Lyra sensed it too and followed their eyes to the sky. A light was moving towards them, a light with wings.
"It's the angel we saw,"
said Pantalaimon, guessing. He guessed correctly. As the boy and the girl and the two demons watched her approach, Zaphania spread her wings wider and glided down to the sand. Will, for all the time he'd spent in the company of Balthamos, wasn't prepared for the strangeness of this encounter. He and Lyra held each other's hands tightly as the angel came towards them, with the light of another world shining on her. She was unclothed, but that meant nothing. What clothes could an angel wear anyway, Lyra thought. It was impossible to tell if she was old or young, but her expression was austere and compassionate, and both Will and Lyra felt as if she knew them to their hearts.
"Will, I have come to ask your help."
"My help? How can I help you?"
"I want you to show me how to close the openings that the knife makes."
"I'll show you. And in return, can you help us?"
"Not in the way you want. I can see what you've been talking about. Your sorrow has left traces in the air. This is no comfort, but believe me, every single being who knows of your dilemma wishes things could be otherwise. But there are fates that even the most powerful have to submit to.